Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there, welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. Hope you're well. What a great show we have for you today. Well, yeah, I would say that, but I think it is probably a great show. It hasn't happened yet. This is the very first thing, but it has the potential to be a good show. I said great at the start. I'm going down already. Good, it's probably going to be an adequate listen, a so-so aural experience. I mean, it won't be the worst thing you've ever heard. Probably. But we do have two guests. Two guests of various stripes talking about Arsenal in different ways. That's good. And we've got a competition for you. Books. We've got those to give away to lucky listeners. As well as that, we'll be discussing all the things that have happened between the last time we spoke and now, looking ahead to the Manchester City game and then everything else in between. So, yeah, there's the potential for it to go wrong somewhere between now and the end, but chances are it'll be absolutely functional. So there. I do think the first thing we should do, though, is bask in the end of this particular interlull. Now, as you know, interlulls in general aren't the most enjoyable experiences because, A, there's no Arsenal. There's international football, which doesn't do a whole lot for me. You got to look at people like Robbie Keane, etc., etc. And, you know, the interlull can send people a little bit stir crazy, a bit doolally at times. And I think that's very true of this particular interlull. Because we had the end of the transfer deadline day, then an interlull, and pretty much nothing in between. And I think the end of this interlull should be celebrated. Like a birthday or a triumph or going all the way through Abe's Odyssey without losing a life. It has been a conspiracy theory heavy interlull. It has. I think if you look up the biggest conspiracy theories in the world, you'll find out that JFK was killed by John Lennon and the moon landings took place on a soundstage somewhere outside Mullingar and the MMR vaccine doesn't just give your kids autism, it makes them paparazzi who drive in tunnels in Paris and kill princesses. That's the level of conspiracy that we've been dealing with this week. All to do, of course, with Danny Welbeck and Arsene Wenger and this concept that Arsene Wenger might not have been the one that signed Danny Welbeck, as if anybody else at Arsenal Football Club is in charge of football and transfers and can do anything without his permission. But no, Arsene Wenger didn't sign him. In actual fact, it was Nelson Vivas! Sorry, I mean Ivan Gazidis. And this all stemmed from the fact that Arsene Wenger didn't say anything after signing him. Because normally when there's a signing, we did all this in the Arscast Extra on Monday, but it lived on through the week. That Arsene Wenger, the football dictator that he is, the man who controls everything, from the colour of the training ground walls to what the players eat, to the labelling on their underpants, which is a true story. Not many people know that one. I'll tell you that a different day. But that all of a sudden he could be emasculated by Ivan Gazidis and a player could be brought in without his knowledge. And then when it became obvious that that scenario was pretty ludicrous and a bit thick, then the goalposts changed. It was like, not why did Ivan Gazidis sign this player, but why hasn't Arsene Wenger said anything about him? He was away and he was another club and did it really matter? He's spoken about him now in his press conference. that happened yesterday. And all of a sudden people were going, he only wanted him on loan. But what he actually said was, at the start, the player was only available on loan. But then when the thing changed and he became available on a permanent basis, I had no hesitation in signing him. And this goes back to the Arscast Extra on Monday. Arsene Wenger's comments in his press conference about how the deal might not have happened if he wasn't travelling that day. He travelled to Rome with one of the agents that the club got in to broker the deal. And this is what James from Gunnerblog had to say about it on the Arscast Extra on Monday.
Basically, the way this deal went down, Danny Welbeck is represented by his brother. He acts as his agent, Chris Welbeck. And I think Arsenal, in order to do this deal and not just be dealing directly with the Welbeck family, brought another agency on board in order to, you know, help manage the negotiations. And actually, I know for a fact that Arsene Wenger himself made a call at about 7:30 in the morning to that agency to express his sort of urgent desire to push this deal through on deadline day. So he was directly involved in the negotiations, and actually representatives of the agency were with him in that infamous airport picture which came out around midday. So that could be relevant or not, but effectively his hand was firmly involved in this transfer. There's no way that he would ever have let it happen without his consent, and it happened, albeit late in the day, at his behest.
So essentially the man who is in charge of deciding what players to buy and whether or not the club should buy them decided to buy a player, and the club bought him. I know, it's frankly unbelievable to me. I just can't get my head around that at all. It's just such a complicated thing that I don't know, we probably need somebody to explain it to us in greater detail. But I think it's just a consequence of this particular interlull that all this has gone down. And when there's no Arsenal to talk about, people, well, they'll go off in tangents. And sometimes those tangents are good and amusing, and other times they're just kind of dense. I think this was one of those times. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that even though it happened late in the day, Arsene Wenger decided that he would buy Danny Welbeck, and that's what he did. And now we've got Danny Welbeck, and that's all we should be getting on with, really. Before we go on with the show, I just want to say thank you to this week's sponsors, the Illuminati. For all your secretly controlling the world needs, why don't you check out their website and stuff? So thank you indeed to the Illuminati. I wonder if the Illuminati can get the Arsenal PR machine to arrange lunches with Ivan Gazidis. I'm just asking for a friend. Anyway, I think we should probably leave that to one side and put it to bed, and let's just get on with stuff. We'll have a look ahead to the Man City game and all the team news that's come in. We have come through the interlull relatively well. One or two little worries, but we'll touch on those a little bit later on. But now, time to welcome our first guest to the show. It is Julian H. from Gingers for Limpar. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. I want to just ask, firstly, what you made of the opening month of the season. Obviously, we're beyond the first interlull now, but the first month or the first couple of weeks of the season were a little bit challenging. Were you expecting that? And what's your overall assessment of how we did in that time?
I'm not really sure what I was expecting. I'm always, I think, a bit nervous at the beginning of the season. You've got, you know, the irrational optimist in the back of your head. You can't kind of wait for it to start, and every fixture suddenly becomes winnable. And, you know, I think we thought every game up until the one tomorrow is winnable. But of course, that one as well, especially being at home. But, of course, it hasn't worked out like that. I would... so disappointing. I can't put it any other way.
Would that be because of the level of performance, or because of maybe what happened at Leicester more than anything, or just in general the way the team hasn't quite clicked?
I think the latter, the overall performances, the results haven't been too bad, really, and got through the European Cup tie, which is the most important thing. When you look back at previous seasons, you know, it does, you realise how important that is compared to other games at the beginning of the season, such as the start of last season, where, of course, which was calamitous, and yet we bounced back quite strongly. But I don't know, it's strange, because, you know, we've in recent seasons, the sort of weakness in personnel, if you like, has been so obvious, and we started the season thinking, you know, we can't challenge. You look at the squad, it's not good enough. We've kind of come a bit used to that, and it's been very obvious where to put the blame, and there have typically been, you know, two or three scapegoats, if not more, in the side, and you can say, well, that's just that. Whereas, you know, this season we do have a very good squad. I know there was more we could have done in this transfer window and the one before it, and arguably the one before that, but essentially we've got, I think, a stronger squad on paper than we've had for an extremely long time. And yet, as you said, it's just the, you know, as we all know, when you're old like us, that it's not that simple. It's often, you know, the teams that look better on paper don't perform as well. And it's that kind of blending. I was watching the game, if you'll forgive me, up the road that happened just before the international break, and you looked at the team sheets, the Tottenham lineup, and the Liverpool lineup, and it didn't look that different in quality. And yet, I mean, for me, Liverpool just on a different level to the home side, and it's Wenger's challenge now. I think one thing he's been so vocal over the summer, and he, you know, his spin is very much, I was restrained by money and there was nothing else I could do, and now we've got the money. And the problem with that is, of course, it kind of, you know, makes a rod for his own back, and he's it kind of isn't that excuse now. And it's up to him to show that he can make these players blend.
Yeah, I mean, it raises expectations also, of course, when you go out and you buy players like Mesut Ozil and Alexis, and you spend big money on those. Interesting in the sense that at the end of last season, he identified the area where the team really needed to improve as the goal scoring part of things, where Manchester City scored 100 goals, Arsenal scored 66. And we all, I think, have our reservations about the depth at the back. And I think those are legitimate concerns, but it looks like what he's done is really try and top load this side. If you look at the additions to the squad, Welbeck, which we can touch on overall in a couple of minutes' time, Welbeck's come in. Joel Campbell is there to add a bit of depth to the squad. Alexis has come in. And then you've got around them Cazorla, you've got Oxlade-Chamberlain, you've got Theo Walcott to come back. Giroud, we know, is there but injured. It does look as if that he's really made a concerted effort to boost the options in that area of the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, when he said before Welbeck signed, he says we have too many forwards line, which almost seemed designed to send some people slipping out. But it's I mean, I in a way, I think that's true. I think a lot of the reservations some of us have there are not about the number of forwards. It's more about who those forwards are, sure. and also sort of how much faith he has in them. I mean, of course, you never really know with him, but you can sense things in terms of where he plays players and when he plays them and how often he plays them or how often he doesn't. And then also just little subtle things about when he's speaking about players. I mean, he's always, of course, generally positive. But so I think for players where he's not so keen on, he doesn't get as kind of passionate about defending them as he does. For example, with Ozil, he gets very passionate and he goes into a lot of detail about what Ozil's doing and what people are missing and stuff. And you certainly don't get that with players like Podolski and even Joel Campbell. You get slightly fainter praise, to say the least. Yeah. And personally, I'm not convinced he's convinced by either of those two players.
I'd agree.
He's he's certainly convinced by Sanogo. But the question is whether that's going to become justified and prove a lot of people wrong, or whether it's going to come back to hit him in the face. But as you see, yeah, the numbers are definitely there. He's clearly front loaded it. It's interesting. Again, though, it comes down to how can the team create more chances and become just more of a kind of naturally goal scoring team. And that's not just down, of course, to having lots of forwards. That's to them. Again, just to use that word, you know, blending and cutting through in the final third. And I think, to come back to your original question, that's one of the disappointments of the first few games of the season, is we just haven't seen that cutting edge creativity in the final third that I think we'd like to see.
Do you think that's one of the big challenges that he's got now, to try and figure out how to get Ozil, Cazorla, Alexis, Welbeck, Walcott, these players into the team and maintain the balance from an attacking point of view? I mean, do you worry that there's a lack of creativity, or just that the balance isn't quite right enough for things to click?
I think it's just in terms of, we haven't sort of found the system. You know, I think with Wenger as well, like he generally fixes on an idea and sticks to it, and then just tries it again and again. And in fairness, often this creates sort of partnerships between players that do blossom, even if it's really unexpected ones, like Song and the Stapleton bloke who went off. This does tend to happen. And I mean, one thing I think we will see this season, hopefully I'm wrong, but I think with the number of attacking players we have, he's not going to suddenly become, a great squad manager and have them coming in and out and, you know, adjusting to tactics and stuff. I think he will try to find a combination of those attacking players which works, or which he thinks will work. And I think a lot of them will end up just sitting on the bench, basically, if that. But it's tough, because of course he's changed to this 4-3-3 as well, which is a bit different to last season. And it's funny, because as you say, he knows that we have to improve the goal scoring. Yet at the same time, in a way, this has made us even a bit more kind of cautious and a bit more midfieldy, if that's kind of a word. And I think that's, I mean, against Everton, for example, I thought a lot of our midfield play was actually very, very good. And I thought we controlled that quite well. But it was the final third again, and then, of course, a couple of defensive mistakes. But we'll have to see. I think that is his challenge. It's a nice problem to have as a manager when you think of the problems he had, you know, with his squad 3 years ago and 4 years ago. It's a nice problem to have a lot of attacking talent and to have the question of how do you merge them. I'd expect, as I said, just two or three to sort of come through and develop a good understanding. Players that, in my opinion, like Walcott, Ozil, Sanchez, and I could see some of the others just kind of really being squeezed out for a lot of the season.
Danny Welbeck's arrived from Manchester United. What did you make of the signing overall? I mean, in the circumstances, it seemed more and more sensible and rational, given that Sanogo had struggled so badly at Leicester, and he wasn't alone in that, but he, you know, has become, after only 17 games, something of a lightning rod for criticism. And I don't think that's, not that it's not fair, but you can understand it when people are looking for Arsenal to challenge and they want to see a better striker than Yaya Sanogo. And I think in Welbeck, we've got a better striker than Yaya Sanogo. I mean, is he the kind of player who can bring out the best of Mesut Ozil? Because we've spoken about how he lacked players with pace and players to make those runs, and with Walcott in the team, with Alexis in the team, they're now, when those guys are fit, is almost an emphasis on pace, whereas before it seemed to be something of an afterthought. With Walcott out of the team, all of Arsenal's pace was gone. And now we have not one, not two, but three options when those guys are all fit and ready, which should change the way that we look to attack.
Yeah, you certainly hope so. And I think it's great that we've got faster players now, but I always think with this question, it's not just a matter of sort of pure pace, if you like, kind of run below sprint challenge kind of thing. It's also about kind of movement and sort of guile, and being also psychologically being prepared to run past players. So some players just, it's just not their game. I mean, Cazorla, for example, is, you know, it's you've got the players who instinctively come deep and look to, you know, keep the ball, and then maybe create, and then those like Ramsey, for example, who is often deep, and of course he's fast, but he's not, you know, Theo Walcott fast yet. He often gets in those positions and runs beyond players, and I think Welbeck will improve that. I mean, one of the things I like Welbeck. I wanted us to sign him. I'm on that side. And one of the things that I liked about watching him for Man United was his intelligence, I think, and his movement was often very good. Of course, you're never entirely sure how much that's the manager and how much it's the player. Like I thought under Ferguson, Welbeck was used very, very cleverly often. I remember when they played away at Real Madrid, and it was a tactical decision, and Welbeck, I thought, was brilliant that night. And not so much last season under Moyes, perhaps. So maybe that says everything. So I mean, perhaps that is again, we're coming back to Wenger's challenge. Like, can he deliver that side of Welbeck where you see the pace and also the kind of the confidence to get into good positions and get fast players, and then also to finish the chances. Sanogo, to come out, that has had some chances in recent games, and sometimes his movement has got him in those positions. The one-on-one against Leicester, for example, where he made a good run but just didn't have the composure or ability or whatever we're saying it is to finish. So yeah, hopefully we will start, and hopefully maybe it will take a bit of the burden off Sanogo. Like you say, I mean, I didn't go to Leicester. I watched it in a well-known pub near the ground, and I said, like, it's, I don't know, there were lots of groans about Sanogo, and I mean, I'm by no means his biggest fan whatsoever, but it's, I mean, hopefully that doesn't happen too much, because as we know, you could potentially kill a player's confidence, I suppose, at this point in his career.
I mean, we've seen it before, haven't we, where the manager has played young players and you look at them and you think, wow, that guy is just not anywhere near ready, and they gain a reputation for being, you know, crap or whatever, and it is just a case of not being ready, and then a couple of years later, you know, there's a different player. So I don't know if that's going to happen yet with Sanogo, but, you know, by the same token, I think I'm very glad that we've brought in Welbeck. Interesting that he spoke about him developing as a player, and certain players that have arrived at Arsenal at his age, at 23, and gone on, as Wenger said, to have huge careers. He found himself a little bit shunted to the sidelines because of the guy we spoke about who might have left us and gone there. And Rooney, of course, playing as a central striker. I mean, he has now, with Giroud out and with Sanogo just not really a convincing option, although he's got Alexis for a bit of competition as the central striking role, with Giroud out until January, he's got 4 months, basically, to establish himself as the team's first team striker. It's a huge opportunity for him as well.
Yeah, it is, and the stuff that we've been hearing about the last 24 hours about it being a permanent deal and not a loan, I mean, that kind of suggests that he's got, you know, he is motivated to make it really work and to have something to build on. I'd expect maybe he has other motivations, but but yeah, absolutely. It's, I mean, he's coming into a team, as we said, there is uncertainty about how we're going to line up and how we're going to play. And in a way, that's probably nice for players. Like when things are kind of rigid and fixed, it can be, I suppose it can kind of close closed doors. Whereas, yeah, if it's you know, if you have that opportunity to win a position for yourself, then that's a huge motivation. And yeah, we'll see. Hopefully, we just don't come to rely on him as much as we did with Jury last season and play him into the ground. So yeah, we'll have to see how that pans out.
Manchester City then tomorrow, and everybody before this game seems to be talking about the 6-3 game at their place, whereas I think our record against them at home is really quite good. Over the last few years, we've won a couple, and I don't think they've won. Maybe there was that crazy game when Koscielny got sent off, wasn't it, in the first few minutes? But yeah, but generally speaking, we've been pretty good against them at home. Do you think the Community Shield, I know it's not necessarily a guide by which you can decide who's going to win the title and which is a better team by any means, but in a way might have broken a little bit of a psychological barrier ahead of this particular game, given that the emphasis has been on our inability to get big results against the bigger teams in this league?
Perhaps, yeah. I half think City was so bad that day. They might have actually have done themselves a favour by just not making it seem like a remotely competitive fixture.
But they were that bad against Stoke as well a couple of weeks ago. They were bad.
And perhaps it's you'd certainly like to think so, and of course, you know, as you're alluding to, like our big game problems were predominantly away from home last season and arguably in seasons before that as well. So you'd expect that wouldn't be, you know, a big psychological problem. I mean, perhaps.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The psychological challenge is exactly that, is when a team goes to Anfield, Stamford Bridge, etc., and then has to sort of confront those demons, if you like. But again, perhaps having new players, having fresh players in the squad, and of course winning the FA Cup in the interim, helps get over that psychological issue. There is also, we'll have to see what Wenger does with his tactics that we were talking about earlier, but I mean, there is this idea that he's changed the system to give us a bit more of a better, sort of stronger approach in those tough games.
Yeah.
So that when you go away to Man City, for example, you've got three men in midfield who can, who can sit there and can protect you a little bit better. Although I seem to think we were lined up a tad like that when we went to City last year. Now that I'm just destroying my point mid-sentence. But perhaps that's the case. But we've got, it's still early in the season as well. And I wouldn't think there'd be too much psychological doubt in our players' minds ahead of Saturday.
Is it a must-win or a must-not-lose?
I think it's more a must-not-lose. I think at this stage of the season, I mean, we could do with more points. Leicester was disappointing, of course. But it's still very early. I'm a big fan early in the season of not losing. I know sometimes it can go the other way. And with Villa last season, sometimes it could give you an early kind of kick up the arse. But I think also teams get confidence from not losing games when you get, especially when you're not playing that great as we're seeing now. Like often, you can almost play yourself into better form by not losing play, and sometimes you get playing is saying, well, we're on an unbeaten stretch. So I'd say it's more that kind of case.
All right. Okay. Look, we better leave it there, but we'll catch up with you again in the near future. Julian H. from Gingers for Limpar, thank you very much.
Great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you indeed to Gingers for Limpar. You can find him on Twitter, of course, at Gingers for Limpar. That's at Gingers for Limpar, where the four is a number four. Right, what we're going to do is take a very short commercial break, and we're going to be right back with our second guest of this week's show.
Get on down to Archie's Sheet Metal Works, Tottenham. Anything you want, we can make it. Gates and railings, food drawers, charcoal grills, domestic and commercial kitchens, even toe caps for your Doc Martens. Archie's Sheet Metal Works, Tottenham. The one right beside the stadium.
Welcome back to this week's Arscast. Time for our second guest of the show. I'm with me an author, Stuart Taylor, who's written a book about an Arsenal player whose career started incredibly and ended tragically. The player in question is Paul Vassan. The book is called Stuck in a Moment, The Ballad of Paul Vassan. And Stuart Taylor, the author, is with me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me.
There are probably a number, people out there right now who don't have any clue who Paul Vassan was, given that what he did happened over a very short period of time and obviously quite a long time ago. Can you give us a little bit of background about who he was?
Yeah, Paul joined Arsenal in the mid-70s, and he worked his way through the youth ranks and the reserve ranks pretty rapidly. And he became effectively the understudy for Frank Stapleton and Alan Sunderland towards the end of the 70s and into the early 80s. His best season was the 79-80 season, when he actually got a run of games and he scored a winner at White Hart Lane in a league match. And then a few days later, he had his big moment when he came on as a substitute and scored the winning goal at Juventus in the Cup Winners' Cup semi-final.
I mean, set the scene there for us a little bit. Arsenal were on the verge of going out.
The first leg had been quite an attritional affair. The Italians were playing like Italians did. Very, very defensive. Going full into tackles. It was quite a nasty game. The Juventus got a penalty and went ahead, but Arsenal managed to grab an equaliser towards the end for a Roberto Bettega own goal. So it stood at 1-1. The Juventus had the away goal, and not many people, to be honest, were giving Arsenal much of a chance.
All right, so he's 19 years of age, and Arsenal are playing in Italy against Juventus, one of the biggest clubs in the world, and Italian football back then was pretty much the creme de la creme of European football. I mean, what did that goal do for him in terms of his profile at such a young age?
Well, it shot him literally onto the front pages of newspapers across Europe, and for a week or so, Paul Vassan was you could say world famous. Nobody knew of him unless you lived in Bermondsey or were an ardent Arsenal fan. So here we go. The expectations suddenly shoot up because here's someone not many players have seen before coming on, scoring away at Juventus, doing something nobody's done before. And all of a sudden, here's our new find. This is our new hero.
Yeah.
And he ultimately found it difficult to live up to that.
I mean, do you think that was... I mean, it's such a brilliant thing to happen, and I don't suppose you'd ever want to take that away from a player. But did it raise expectations to the point where people were looking at him to do things he wasn't quite capable of at that stage of his career?
Yes, definitely, because although an injury interceded, if you jumped a year down the line, he was getting hammered by the fans for his apparent inability. And it was at a time when the Arsenal crowd was already fed up with the fact that Brady had been allowed to go, then Stapleton had been allowed to go. And here was this young kid who couldn't do the things that Stapleton had done. And the Arsenal crowd at that time, around 81, 82, when we couldn't score a goal at Highbury to save ourselves, was pretty unforgiving.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment in the book where you talk about how he's come back, and we'll touch on the injury in a moment. But he's come back, and I think it was a UEFA Cup game. And
that's right, Winterslag.
There's a guy on the terraces shouting, "Vasanov, Vasanov." And
that's right.
Paul's brother is there on the terraces, who knows what he's been through from an injury point of view and how hard he's worked. And these guys are giving him all this grief. And it ends up with him fighting fans around him on the north bank.
Yeah, that's right.
Fighting his corner. I mean, it's a remarkable, it's a remarkable and sad story, really, that it would come to that. I mean, these days we know what a player goes through when they get injured because of wall-to-wall media and blogs and news sites and Twitter and everything else that I'm involved in. We know everything, all the details. I mean, do you think there was at that time perhaps a lack of understanding about how serious what had happened to him was?
I think definitely, because he actually went through a lot of his rehabilitation on his own. He was actually away from the club for quite a while, and he was doing a lot of rehab with his brother in the park. I think the difference between then and now is players get more protection. If it happened today, I think with the injuries that he got, his knee was literally effectively shredded. He would have been protected more, I think, by Arsene Wenger. He would have ruled him out for a year. He would have let him recuperate slowly, like he's done with countless players. And I think Arsenal probably brought him back maybe a bit too quickly when his skill was compromised by his injuries, his lack of ability to twist and turn and make sharp movements.
Yeah. The injury itself, it happened in a game against Tottenham.
That's right.
I mean, from what you say in the book, he did his cartilage, his ligaments, his cruciate, everything in his knee went. And this was at a time when there were no such things as scans. You talk about the consultant coming in and he's lying on the table and he puts a thumb on the side of his knee and it's like, oh yeah, your knee is fucked, basically. But you know, there isn't or wasn't the understanding of these kind of injuries back then, and the chances of him recovering from it. I'm just saying the chances of him recovering from an injury like that, which even today would be a challenge for the best surgeons with all the technology and all the advancements in medicine and scans, it would be a challenge to bring a player back. For him to undergo that kind of injury was always going to be hugely detrimental.
Yeah, and I think going back to your point about communication, I've looked back in the programmes at the time and there's no sort of update that you get now on the players in the on the website or in the match day programme. It's almost like he wasn't not just him, I think it was anyone that was injured, especially long term. They weren't forgotten about, but it was you know, the play, we weren't fed regular updates, and I think we didn't know how seriously injured he was.
I mean, even he didn't seem to quite understand how seriously injured he was, because I know it was a different time and a different culture, and the story about Raphael Meade coming in to give him a six-pack of special brew in hospital, I think, kind of sums that up. But even to the point where he was so desperate and so working so hard to get back for Arsenal that his attitude was like, fuck the doctors, what do they know? And he was going to, he went to the park and he did these exercises, which I'm sure he did hoping or with the best faith that they would be good for him. But nowadays you would say, look, there's a point where you need to rest, and then slowly, slowly. So it's very much a victim of the time.
Yeah, definitely. I think he was determined. He was very determined to, that he was going to get back in the first team. And he, like you say, his attitude was that he just wasn't listening to the doctors, the consultants. He even went over to America to speak to the specialists there. And he didn't listen to what they told him to do. So he's probably ended up doing more damage to himself than you know, doing extra damage to himself. So, I think he's definitely probably could have listened a bit more.
Ultimately, that put paid to his footballing career, that injury and the problems with his knee. And it's a difficult thing, you know, I think for anybody who loves football and who loves playing football, regardless of the level you play it at, when you have an injury that prevents you from doing the thing you love, it's a very difficult thing to cope with. But when it's at the top level of the game, well, maybe Arsenal weren't quite top level back then, but, you know, this is professional football. It's a big, big gap to fill. And unfortunately, his life after football took a very dark turn.
Yeah, I mean, he's not obviously the first one that's faced these problems, and he won't be the last. And what he's always quite bitter towards Arsenal, because he felt that they'd left him unprepared, basically, for life after football. The phrase I've used is that he'd been sort of seduced and abandoned. And it's a difficult one, because Arsenal did, you have to say, they did spend 2 years trying to get him right and giving him 3 operations and still paying his wages, etc. But there obviously came a point where they had to say that this is not going to work, and Paul had to find something else to do. And I think he just coped incredibly difficultly without any other meaning in life. I think that's probably what he was spending the rest of his life trying to find. And it wasn't until he found God much later on that I think he did find something. But even then, that was just a passing phase. But I think, you know, players, even today, we hear of clubs taking kids on when they're 8 and 9 years old, and they're telling them they're going to be stars and they're going to do this and that, and 99% of them don't make it.
Yeah.
So you've got those young kids that are rejected. You've got people who retire early, and you've even got the people who retire after a full career. You know, there's only so many jobs in coaching and in working on TV. And if you don't go into those fields, you've got to find something else, and it's usually something a lot more mundane than what you've been doing.
Do you think that perhaps there is, when we talked about that desire of his to get back and playing, that was almost self-destructive because of...
Yes, I think so, because...
You know, that was a personality trait that sadly he took on then.
Yes, because I think Paul was his brother mentions in the book a couple of times, was all or nothing. He was 100% or 0%. And I think he went from being 100% football to 0% football, because he stopped watching games. He was offered the chance to go and coach kids in Malta, and he had other similar offers, and he turned them flat down because he didn't want anything to do with football anymore. So I think his mindset didn't help him much. As I say, he was just sort of an all or nothing type of character, which unfortunately I am as well. It's one of the things we've got in common.
Yeah. It ended in August 2001 for Paul after a long struggle with drugs and with alcohol.
Yeah.
And when you see a story like that, a guy who at 19 looked like he had the world at his feet and so many years later has nothing, it does show you how fickle the game of football is. But in writing this book, have you been able to... I know that you've spoken with his family a great deal.
Yeah.
Is there something good that can come out of the story? Particularly for his mother, I think, that she doesn't seem to have, until quite recently, come to terms with what's happened or with what happened to him.
No, and one of the things that she's mentioned to me about the book is that it has helped her do that. The same for Paul's brother, Lee, as well, who's never really got around to dealing with it himself. And I think, I'm hoping it's given them some form of closure. Closure might not be the right word, because it sounds like you're not going to think about it anymore. And of course, I think about him every day. But I think really... Hello?
Hi, yeah, no, I'm listening, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I think really the other thing is that it helped... It's helped Maureen in that her son is being talked about again. And she felt, like Paul, that he'd been forgotten a bit by the football community. And bringing him back into the forefront with this book and having the book launch, Arsenal, etc., and having some ex-players there has made her feel quite good that Paul's not been forgotten.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's obviously a sad story, but if it ultimately has a positive effect on her and the rest of his family, then that's a good thing. The book is called Stuck in a Moment, The Ballad of Paul Vassan by Stuart Taylor, published by GCR Books. Stuart, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks to Stuart, and also thanks to GCR Books, who have given me three copies of Stuck in a Moment, The Ballad of Paul Vassan, to give away to you. All you have to do, if you would like to win one, is answer this very, very simple question. Against whom did Paul Vassan score that goal in Europe to put Arsenal into the final of the Cup Winners' Cup? Who did he score against the goal that made him famous? All you have to do is send your answer to competition@arseblog.com. That's competition@arseblog.com. The random number generator will pick three winners, and I'll announce those on next week's Arsecast. So, now all we have to do is look ahead to the game tomorrow against Manchester City. And after the interlull, we've obviously got to get back into the swing of things. Injury news and team news is quite good. We've got Mikel Arteta back after his sprained ankle. Mesut Ozil is in the squad, despite some worries that he might not make it. He went away with Germany for the interlull and didn't play at all, so I was a little bit worried that he might have been a bit more injured after doing his ankle at Leicester. He's back in the team. Kieran Gibbs is back in the squad. Lauren Koscielny is back in. David Ospina, the goalkeeper, he's fit, so we're kind of operating almost at full tilt here. There is a worry, though, about Aaron Ramsey after he turned his ankle on that pitch in Andorra for Wales the other night. So that's a bit of a worry. He might miss out, and that would be a blow, obviously, given the influence that he has on this team. Even when he doesn't play well, he's got the ability to pop up and get us a goal. But in general terms, it does look as if we're, you know, as healthy as we have been for quite some time. It'll be interesting to see the team that the manager picks. He's got Ozil, he's got Cazorla, he's got Alexis, he's got Oxlade-Chamberlain, he's got Wilshere. We've got new boy Danny Welbeck, who has to start. In my opinion, he's got to start on Saturday after his two goals in midweek. He is the best candidate that we've got. We've just spent 17 or 18 million pounds on him. Let's play him as a striker, even though Arsene Wenger did what he normally does, is say, yes, his best position is a striker, but of course he's a versatile player. But I think if you were to go back and look at the Arsenal.com records and check every signing that he makes, he might say, yes, he's a versatile player, apart from Shamak, maybe, and Park. I doubt he said that about them. But Welbeck, I think, will start up front, and with the likes of Ozil and Cazorla and Alexis in and around him and behind him, we shouldn't be found wanting from an attacking point of view. The first month of the season was functional, I think you might say. We've got through it. We did kind of what we had to do, even if Leicester, you look back on that, as dropped points, but we won at home against Palace. We got through to the Champions League. We got a draw away against Everton. Had to dig deep to do that. And we know that the World Cup and the preseason wasn't ideal. But here we are now in September. It's mid-September. Blimey, it's mid-September already. Well, heading towards mid-September. And we should be fully fit, match fit and sharp. And this is a team now that really has to start clicking, even if there are some decisions that the manager has to make. So that's just about that. Let's keep everything crossed. I hope to see some of you in the usual place on Saturday. I'm over for the game. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to watching us win, of course. So we'll leave it there for this week. We'll be here on Monday, myself and James, with an Arscast Extra, looking back on what happened at the weekend. So until then, take it easy. Have a great weekend. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Hello? Yes, Ivan. It's Daniel here, Daniel Levy. Yes, how are you? Delighted to hear that. Delighted. This laughter isn't at all fake to butter you up. Anyway, look, we've been having a few problems. I don't know if you've noticed on the news, but with our new stadium. Yeah. It is a bit. Yeah. But look, I just wanted maybe to sit down and maybe we could have a chat about a solution that we could find between us. You know, you've got a lovely big ground there, and we, well, don't. So maybe I can take you to lunch. Is there anywhere in particular you'd like to go? I mean, it's on me, of course. What's the name again? It's a French restaurant, is it? No Chance. Sounds great. And the address? What is it? 1961... Farkov Road, great. And just in case I get there a bit early, is there anything on the menu that you'd recommend? The Up the Garden Path Salad. Sounds delicious, actually. Oh. Very good, Ivan. Very good indeed. Norma. Can you get me David Gold's number? Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.